Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The West is self-centered, egotistical, and very unaware. This is particularly true when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine. For the West, Ukraine is some kind of moral crusade. For the rest of the world, Ukraine is a crisis created by the West, and they don't want to have anything to do with it. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Pepe Escobar. He's an independent geopolitical analyst and author specializing in Eurasia. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Pepe here in Moscow. Pepe, a lot has been made of the international reaction to Russia's military operations in Ukraine. And I think we all have to agree the West is sorely disappointed because people have not got on board with condemning Russia. Now, we had just a few days ago, China came out with its own proposal to resolve the conflict, more or less blown off by the West, very much like the West blew off Russia's demands before the conflict started in December, the demands that were made in December 2021. So how do you account for this? I mean, do they no longer believe the West? They're not afraid of the West? They don't hold the same values as the West? How do you see it?
Well, first of all, I am in Moscow for 1 week now. For me, it's an enormous privilege to be here because I'm learning so much. I'm talking to a wide spectrum from the highest levels to the men in the street. And obviously, if you are in the West or even if you are in Asia, it's absolutely impossible. You have to be here. I see it as the capital of the 21st century, and I wrote about it. Well, first of all, let me concentrate on three BRICS. Very, very important. I will say that these three BRICS, apart from Russia, are on the forefront of what might be our emerging multipolar world. And their reactions are very different. Apparently, China and Brazil are interested in playing a role of mediators. But there's an enormous problem. China releases a very detailed peace plan, 12-point peace plan, which, of course, Chinese diplomacy knew it would be rejected by the West. But the Global South paid attention. And for the Global South, China is a responsible global power offering a way out, a peaceful way out, which is directly linked to the Chinese concept of community, of shared benefits for mankind, prosperity for mankind. Brazil wants to pose as a mediator, but we have Lula visiting Biden in Washington, lighting up the Christ the Redeemer statue with a Ukrainian flag in Rio, and worse, voting against Russia at the UN. So what was the Russian reaction? Lavrov, master diplomat, said, we understand the situation of the Brazilian government at the moment, which is true, because Lavrov knows that Lula's margins of maneuver is like this. And Brazil has been taken hostage by globalists, Soros, Davos, Biden administration altogether. But Ryabkov, deputy foreign minister, he actually said what the Russians think. Your mediation proposal is basically irrelevant. We're not paying attention to you. They are paying attention here in Moscow to Russia, to China, sorry. And India. India, of course, India, the other three large BRICS, influential BRICS, the position is much more nuanced. India is, in theory, but the diplomatic support behind Russia, as we saw it during the G20 in New Delhi. And of course, the trade volumes between India and Russia, which keep going up, especially on the energy sphere, show that India understands the Russian position and obviously influences the rest of the global south. Go ahead, Peter.
It's really interesting. These countries that believe in a multipolar world are actually behaving that way because they're not in sync here. George, jump in. Go right ahead.
Well, yeah, I was wondering because we talked about India's role in the G20 on the Gaggle a couple of days ago, and it seemed like India had failed. I mean, it had failed to step up to the plate to act as an independent great power. It had failed because it prepared a joint statement for the G20, apparently unaware that by copying and pasting two paragraphs from the Bali communique, that would be fine. But not only did Russia say we're not going to accept these two paragraphs, but so did China. So basically, there was no joint statement. And that was really down to India, because if India really wants to be, as they present themselves, the voice of the global South, much more so than China, the voice of the global South, then India could and should have insisted that we will only discuss those items on the agenda that are important to, you know, the global South, with namely food prices, fertilizer prices, energy prices, debt relief, pharmaceuticals, patents, and all that kind of stuff. But India didn't do that. And so I just wonder, why didn't India do that? And there are rumors going around that India is now under pressure from George Soros. And where Soros goes, there goes the United States, and they want to get rid of Modi. They don't think Modi is sufficiently with the program, and that India has been intimidated, has been scared off.
Before Pepe answers, this is going on at the same time where trade between India and Russia is growing leaps and bounds. Almost over the course of 1 year, a unique, huge energy relationship. So kind of echoing George's question here, I mean, on the diplomatic front, there was some trepidation. On all other fronts, it seems like China's already made its decision. Pepe.
Well, Peter and George, India was in the same position in New Delhi as Indonesia was in Bali during the G20 in Bali. They were under tremendous aggressive pressure from the combined West, including, of course, von der Leyen, representing the European Union and the European Commission as well. So the Indians are... It's interesting because what I heard here in Moscow from sources close to diplomatic sources is that they also understand the Indian position. And Lavrov talked to Jaishankar before. Lavrov and Jaishankar, they had a fantastic bilateral meeting before the beginning of the G20. They knew that the foreign ministry summit would be hijacked by the West again. And of course, what India tried to do in the final declaration was, was strategically was not very, very clever. It was a copy and paste job, in fact. They should have come up with a different declaration. But they knew that if they came with their own final declaration draft, it would be immediately rejected. So they tried to, you know, cut it both ways. It didn't work because it looked like a shoddy job. You're absolutely right, both of you. But at the same time, they are postponing, the clash, because they know the clash is going to happen in a few months from now, after Xi's visit to Moscow, during and immediately after the BRICS summit in South Africa in August. So we have a lull at the moment. After August, I think that the West is going to go completely off scale, off rails in terms of freak out, because then we're going to see the situation in Donbass turning completely against.
What's the point of the G20 then?
Excellent question.
If the G7 can show up and hijack it, they already have the G7. So why? For me,
exactly.
It's an exercise in futility.
And that's what's going to happen. We only had one voice from the West so far, basically saying that G20 is dead, was Zoltán Pozsar. When Zoltán Pozsar, at the end of December, he wrote two very, very sharp basically advice to Credit Suisse clients. And he actually said that, look, instead of saying BRICS 5, I came up with G7 of these. This is the G7 that really matters. And it's going to be an expanded G20. Lavrov said this week there are over 24 candidates want to get into BRICS Plus. So it's not a dozen anymore. Everybody wants to get into BRICS Plus. And during the Valdai this week here, I heard this from Arabs as well. Everybody in the Arab world wants to be part of BRICS. So this is the new thing. The
G20, yeah, but I mean, it would be diluted. I'm not really sure of the point here. Then it ends up being a dinner club, George.
No, I quite agree. It does just become a dinner club. And, you know, particularly as the, you know, the G7, as you say, Peter, dominates. And really, this is where the problem is. I mean, what the United States has laid down, particularly with the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines, is that the United States isn't going to tolerate some kind of a new ordering of the world dominated by, you know, China's Belt and Road Initiative and so on, that you're simply not going to accept this. And therefore, the United States will go ahead and sabotage it in whatever way it can. And that's why when, you know, India comes along and sort of essentially wants to play both sides. Well, we're part of the Quad, but we're also the voice of the Global South. And then when, unfortunately, countries that are clearly in the U.S. crosshairs, and but still make nice with the U.S., and I'm thinking particularly the countries of Central Asia, and who will obviously be part of the Belt and Road Initiative, then, you know, I'm not quite so sanguine as to, you know, how successful this new venture will be.
We don't know how a BRICS Plus is going to be expanded. Lavrov already said many times, we need serious discussions before August, the summit in South Africa, to finalize the mechanism. And this is going to be very complicated because now they are also dealing with an amputated BRICS member, which is Brazil. Brazil, for the moment, is not the B in Brazil should be maybe in the short term, Belarus or Bolivia. Brazil, for the moment, is dead. In terms of a BRICS actor. Unfortunately, I had to recognize this after many red alerts from, I know Lula, for instance, but and now it's that's it. You know, it's lost, at least for the moment. But the most important thing is the parallel paths being followed by China, Russia, and India. For instance, India, they are concentrated not on the Belt and Road. They are concentrated on the International North-South Transportation Corridor, which is Russia, Iran, and India. Iran becoming a member of BRICS, like they are becoming a member of the SCO, we're going to have a mega push. And this is already something that I heard in Moscow this week.
Okay, Pepe, we got to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news today.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Children at St. Anne's Residential School suffered nightmarish levels of abuse, torture, and child rape, and yet the Office of the Attorney General suppressed thousands of pages of police evidence that identified those perpetrators.
In the school, I was electrocuted twice. I was only 7 years old. It was too high for me, so somebody put me in the chair. Father Lavoie used to run over here after he abused somebody and run here and seek absolution and whip himself.
Some of them are my relatives that didn't make it, drinking themselves to death, overdoses.
But you know what it made me? It made me the person I am today, because I'm a fighter. I don't give up with anything.
Investigations were too often handled differently because the deceased was indigenous.
So many of the worst criminals got away. The bishops got away. The ones who'd done most of the damage never got charged.
Well, Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Georgia in Budapest here. I mean, the West always plays the same tune. Either you're with us or you're against us. Now, Ukraine has turned into an epicenter for a lot of different things. The reason why we're doing this program here is that, okay, maybe, you know, there are countries that are trying to take a middle road like India. But the slide is very, very evident. Is that more and more countries in the global south, the global majority, are saying, no, we're going to sit this one out. And there are consequences for it, and everyone's bracing for it. But if the U.S. wants to sanction the entire world, then it's a futile struggle, George. We're at a tipping point of some nature.
Yes, I mean, there's no question. I think that you know, the rest of the world has indeed said, no, we're not going along with the sanctions. This isn't our fight. This is, you know, this is a European problem, not a global problem. You want to present as a global problem. But it's clear, I mean, that the United States, particularly under Biden, and who knows what comes up, is presenting a very much a dividing line in the world. I mean, you know, Biden is a very divisive president, and just as he's doing a very divisive thing in the United States, these are the scum, the unacceptable, and these are the acceptable. He's doing much the same thing in the rest of the world, and he's saying, you know, you have to choose which side you're on. And it's not like, it's like, okay, fine, we'll do what we want. They're going to come at you if you don't follow the line. We have the color revolutions always on hand. We've got all the sanctions always on hand. And, you know, we have a regime change. I mean, the very fact that they're trying to push Modi out. I mean, Modi has been, you know, very, very delicately poised in his relationship, shows that essentially with the United States, they are going to really say, you have to join with us. If not, then things are going to be very bad for you.
Well, Pepe, weigh in on that, because, you know, there's so many countervailing forces in play here. We have votes at the United Nations, but a lot of the countries that voted to, against Russia in the United Nations want new trade relationships here. I mean, there's so many different things going on simultaneously. I mean, is it maybe that a lot of these countries think that the U.S. and its allies can control the plane called diplomacy, but then the rest of it, it's just puff, and we're going to go do what we're going to do, because they aren't engaging in sanctions. On the political realm, they seem to go along. But what really counts, they just say, no, we're not going to get involved. I mean, how do you, is that a fair characterization?
I think at in different latitudes, and this is another thing that struck me here on the sidelines of Valdai in Moscow. Talking to Turks, Pakistanis, Arabs, Iranians, they more or less, you could feel that they were saying, look, something big is going to happen soon. We don't know exactly what it is. So we have to be ready for all sorts of scenarios. For them, the number one scenario is trade among them in Eurasia, including the Arabs as well, and trying to bypass U.S. sanctions. And of course, the underlying issue, trying to bypass the West dollar in the long run. Everybody knows this is a very long process, but the train has already left the station. At the same time, this means concentration on trade corridors. So in terms of South America, is a Mercosur trade corridor. In terms of Russia, Iran, and India, the international North-South, which has ramifications to the Caucasus as well, and Central Asia from India, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. And the Indians are very much looking in terms of enhanced trade for them, let's say the Indian version of the Silk Roads. And at the same time, China already said from at the start of the year, the new Silk Roads are back this year. There's going to be a BRI summit in Beijing later this year as well. This means that Chinese investment, not only across Eurasia, but West Asia, what we used to be the Middle East, and Africa and Latin America are going up inevitably. Well, so everybody's concentrating on trade, in fact, because yeah. They can, Peter, just 30 seconds, if you allow me. They know that the American Plan A from now on is going to be a mix of CIA covert ops and attempts at regime change all over the planet, literally.
Well, George, I mean, I thought it was all about democracy and autocracy. Maybe he hasn't said anything yet. Or maybe he's going to get to it. You get my point, George.
Right. No, I think that's right. And I think that's why there is a kind of geopolitical global struggle. I mean, it's as acute as at any time during the Cold War. You have basically the Russia-China bloc. I mean, for the time being, that is a bloc, you know, whether it actually becomes a military alliance or not, but, you know, it is a bloc now. And then you have the basically NATO land and its various adjuncts around the world, such as Japan. This NATO land bloc isn't going to allow the Russia-China bloc to somehow dominate and say, oh, just, you know, continue with trade and then, you know, and so on, and they become our infrastructure, our hinterland. They're not going to do it. I mean, they, you know, we've seen, you know, how they act with like Nord Stream. They saw Nord Stream as a big, big geopolitical threat to them. That's why they were set out to destroy it. And as Timur Hirsch pointed out, the plan was in place even before February the 24th. In other words, they saw this as a serious threat. That's how they're going to see, you know, in the future with anything to do with the Belt and Road Initiative. So ultimately, many countries are going to have to decide. You know, they can't just allow Russia to do all the heavy lifting and then they can just sit and twiddle their thumbs and say, well, I'm going to, you know, be here with the Quad 1 minute and then I'll be, you know, with the Russians the next minute. So it is, I think it's going to be a very acute geopolitical struggle.
Well, you know, something, Pepe, something that George and I have talked about on our podcast, The Gaggle, is that this is the first time in our lifetime that a great power is challenging another great power directly. You correct. Always avoid that, because if you do that, you could lose, okay? When you do it indirectly, you do it through proxy, blowing up pipelines and all that kind of stuff, you know, fine. But I mean, when you're going toe-to-toe, that's a no-no. You shouldn't do that because it can spell disaster. Pepe.
Well, we're not dealing with Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, exactly. And Syria anymore. And we're not dealing with the beginning, the middle part, and the ending of the war on terror. We all knew that that was an absolutely fake concept from top to bottom, right? To justify something that they wanted to do in the first place, which is take over Islamic lands that happen to be very rich in energy or minerals or both. Now it's a different story. Now it's the ultimate Mackinder, Mahan, Spikeman, Brzezinski. You know, we have our whole list of geopoliticians. Nightmare. We have not only one peer competitor in Eurasia. We have a strategic alliance of two peer competitors, and they are very strong individually, not to mention together. So can you imagine in those very, very narrow minds across the Beltway who were born, grew up, and lived through Mackinder all their lives? No wonder they're freaking out, because this is the real deal. This is a system, the emergence of an alternative system all over the world, the emergence of the global South in one hand, but also the emergence of ancient powers that are coming back to the forefront of the table. In the case of China, they had a small interval of 150 years, which in their millenary history is nothing. So they're back to the position that they were for most of recorded history. And in the case of Russia was always a big power for the past 500 years at least. So for Russia is also, and of course the rest of the global South are looking, okay, at least we have a sort of a vanguard with a stripping of any ideological reference. But Russia and China are the vanguard nowadays for the rest of the planet, trying to find a more equitable system. And obviously, as you said, for the elites, the Atlanticist elites, this is beyond anathema, right?
Yeah, because George, I mean, the West is always portraying it as some kind of ideological struggle, and the when they look at, you know, the achievements, and I think they're real, of post-war Europe, prosperity, you know, a lot of largesse, security, and they did it off of Russian energy. So I mean, that's why India said, hey, we might do that too. That's not a bad way of approaching. China also here, but because the West always covers everything in ideology. I think for a lot of people in the South, it's I have no idea what you're talking about. Okay, we want to pull people out of poverty. I don't know what you're talking about, but we know what we want to do, George.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. But when one side is ideological, I think the other side also has to up the ante, raise the game, and make it ideological as well. As happened during the Cold War. I mean, you had, you know, the ideology of the communist world. So the non-communist world had to come up with an alternative ideology. Walt Rostow, Karl Popper, the whole Hannah Arendt, you know, it was all, you created this ideological mix of this is the West, the anti-communist West. So I think something of this sort is happening now. And it's Russia, once again, that's articulating an alternative ideology. I mean, we have obviously the decadence of the West, the exploitative neo-colonial West, national sovereignty, basically the respect for the UN Charter. It's a kind of ideological mix that the Russians are cobbling together. We don't fully see the how it's going to shape up. But I think you have to, if one side is waging an ideological fight.
Well, I mean, Pepe, we got 45 seconds here, but
okay.
Because the West makes it ideological, I think George is right, because these rules-based order, wokeism and all that, there is going to be a fundamental and unified reaction to that, and it's in the cards. Go ahead, Pepe.
Yes. Well, the Chinese concept is community for a shared future for mankind, which when you break it all down, it's peaceful modernization, peaceful trade, and peaceful relations according to the UN Charter, which is not respected by the West as a whole, especially by the United States. And the Russians have the concept of Greater Eurasia Partnership, which is basically a unified Eurasia, including the peninsula called Europe. Everybody doing trade a la China, right? Which is something that Putin proposed in 2007 at the Munich Security Conference, and nobody paid attention. So they intersect in what they would like to have in terms of a new system. And as you said, and George,
we're almost out of time, but
it's impossible. They will never accept it.
And Pepe is absolutely right. You know, on the Eurasian landmass, that little part on the end there, that's called Europe, and that's how it's going to become irrelevant. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.